Hi, I'm Marisa McClellan, author of Food in Jars.
And I'm Joy Manning, editor of Edible Philly.
Welcome to Local Mouthful. We're here to talk about living the food life in Philadelphia and beyond. This week, we're talking about tofu, carbon steel skillets, and string beans. But first, let's compare notes on something we read this week.
Yes. Well, you may have seen, it was reported in the Boston Globe and the Washington Post, among other outlets, America's Test Kitchen is suing Christopher Kimball over his new project, Milk Street, which is a magazine that just came out and will be a TV show and a radio show as well. It basically says that they ripped off the format and intellectual property, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. A little backstory was, which is that Chris Kimball broke with the company in 2015. I think he was pretty much fired.
That's the impression I've gotten as well. Because they brought in a new CEO, and he had been acting as the CEO as well as sort of the figurehead, the face of the company, and they let him go.
Yeah, I think he sold his majority stake, and he ended up with just, I think, less than 10% of the company, which he still holds, actually. But, you know, as a consumer, I was really excited to see Milk Street because I like all that kind of home cooking content. And, you know, for me, there's never been enough of what America's Test Kitchen does. I've always wanted more and more of it. I guess the question is, how similar is it? It's pretty similar. The page count is the same. The format is very similar. There's no ads. The content, like the focus of the content is somewhat different. With Milk Street, Chris Kimball is trying to sort of like learn things from cuisines around the globe. He's trying to like sort of modernize the approach to home cooking. I've read he said in places that there's only so much he can do with the oatmeal cookie recipe. He's like done it all. So I have the first issue of Milk Street, and I have to say I really like it.
Yeah.
We'll talk about it later. I am not saying I like it more than Cook's Illustrated or America's Test Kitchen, but I like it as I like it as much.
One of the things that I found really interesting about the article, and I will say that I have never been a huge Chris Kimball fan. I like the concept of America's Test Kitchen, but in practice, I guess there's something in me that bristles at the idea of there's one best way to do something, which is the whole premise behind America's Test Kitchen. Mm-hmm. And I've always found Chris Kimball to be sort of smug and obnoxious. But I appreciate sort of the body of work that they produced. So seeing this happen to Chris Kimball and his new venture has left me with a little inner chortle, which I feel a little bit bad to admit. But the thing that I found really interesting is the TV aspect that, for instance, WGBH in Boston is no longer going to be the presenting PBS station for the America's Test, or like the Cook's Illustrated America's Test Kitchen show, because they decided to partner with Milk Street instead. And I thought that that was really telling, that it does seem like he is sort of using and exploiting his contacts to diminish the other business.
Another question, though, and I know I'm not a law, I don't know anything about the legal aspect of it, but Chris Kimball and America's Test Kitchen are in a lot of ways synonymous.
Yeah.
You know, it has grown out. He's like the personality that the whole thing has grown out of. And I don't doubt that they can sustain that on their own. There's so many great talents that have been there in the past and that are now there. But do they just expect him to stop being what he is?
That's like, true.
Do they have a copyright on his whole worldview and approach to work?
Well, and it doesn't seem like they're saying that he had any sort of non-compete guarantee in his contract when he left, which I find fascinating, because if they had been actually concerned about this, you'd think that they would have made him sign some sort of thing where for 3 years he couldn't, you know, produce a new venture or something like that. So it seems like it'll be a fascinating unfolding story.
Yeah. But if you guys have looked at Milk Street, I'm really curious as to what you think about it. We're going to talk a little bit more about it in this episode later on, but I'd love to know if you guys have picked it up or it came to your house and what you thought. Now let's talk about what's for dinner.
All right. What is for dinner, Joy?
Tofu?
I love tofu.
Do you?
I do.
I didn't know that. Tell me how you like to make it.
I really love either sort of getting it a little bit crispy. So cutting into slabs and pressing it and then pan frying it and then doing it with some sort of like red curry coconut sauce. It is not something my husband really enjoys. So that's the sort of thing I'll make when he's not around. I've also gone through phases in life where I do a lot of baked tofu, where again, I'll cut it into slabs and press it out and then marinate it and then bake it and become sort of this easy sort of sandwich protein thing you can use on salads.
I frequently forget how much I like it.
It's really delicious.
There is one thing that I get often that has tofu as the main ingredient. I don't make this at home, but the tofu banh mi.
Oh, yeah.
Which I just love. And I probably eat two of those a month, I would say. But for as far as cooking tofu at home, I will go like three or six months without doing it. And like kind of just totally forgetting all about it. Even though, and we've talked about this on the show before, I love Melissa Clark's recipe for shredded tofu with shiitake mushroom stir fry.
Yeah.
It's a really great one. And this week, I got it in my head that I want to make tofu, and I saw this recipe at Food & Wine. This is an older recipe from Food & Wine for hoisin, like a peanut butter hoisin glazed crispy tofu.
And that sounds good.
I'm going to make that tomorrow night. I can't wait.
That sounds delicious. Well, and I must also give a shout out to my very favorite tofu thing in life, which we've talked about on the show before, which is Toby's tofu pate that you cannot get on the East Coast. And that is the thing I long for most about life in Oregon.
Are you going to go to Portland over the holidays?
No. Oh. No, we're going to Austin.
I was going to ask you to bring me back some.
Well, I don't know if I mentioned this last time we talked about it, but I've actually had it confiscated at security at the airport because they deem it a paste, and a paste qualifies as a liquid. So I remember once years ago, I had brought it with me because I was going to eat it for lunch on the airplane, and they confiscated it. And I was like, but you don't understand. That's my lunch.
That stinks.
And it was when I was in grad school and I had no money, and I was so upset that I stood there outside of security once I'd gone through just weeping until some nice businessman came over and asked me if I was okay.
Oh, that's a sad story about tofu.
And then I had to say they took my tofu pate.
I guess I'm only going to get it if I go to Oregon.
You got to go to Oregon.
Well, I thought we could use this opportunity to talk about some of the things that go wrong when people try to make tofu.
Yes.
I think that a reason why people don't like it is because it's so poorly prepared and presented. I have had salads at restaurants that were some kind of tofu, green salad with tofu on it, and I have gotten just raw, cold chunks of tofu out of the box, like chopped on top of the salad.
Yeah, that's no good.
No one would like that.
No.
So I think that, and you mentioned this, like not patting it dry or pressing it. That's a mistake that people make to get the extra water out of it. Tofu is very neutral.
Yeah.
Even bland, more so than something like even chicken, I think. So it needs a tremendous amount of seasoning, in my opinion.
Seasoning or texturizing, I feel like. If you fry it or bake it to give it some texture, that can substitute for flavor. But you're right, it needs either flavor, it really needs a lot of marinade or...
In my mind, it needs both.
Yeah, I can see that.
I haven't baked tofu in a long time, but I do love it like shallow fried in some oil until it's quite crispy.
Yeah.
Either in slabs or cubes. And then you can make a big batch ahead, put it in your freezer, and then that is good for on top of a salad or in a glaze like I'll be making later in the week. I'll report back on this specific recipe and share it with you guys if I deem it worthwhile.
I think it does merit to say, too, that it's important when you're working with tofu to make sure you're choosing the right variety for what you want to do with it. So if you're doing something where you really want it to hold its texture, you want it to stay in shape, if you cut it into cubes, you want to go for a firmer tofu.
Firm or extra firm.
Extra firm. Or if you were doing something like a homemade miso soup where you just want sort of silky little cubes, then you're going to go for a silken or a light textured tofu. So be aware that it comes in very different textures, I guess,
tofu is basically like a cheese that made out of soybeans, so exactly. You know, the firmer stuff, the curds have been pressed, had more of the moisture pressed out of it, more like a crumbly dry cheese, whereas the silken tofu has had less moisture pushed out of it, so that's more like a runny, you know, moist cheese, vaguely speaking.
Good way to think about it.
But silken tofu, I don't buy that a lot, but it has some really great uses. I have made this pie. It's a recipe of Alton Brown's. It's a chocolate silken tofu pie.
Ooh.
It's really good.
That sounds delicious.
If that recipe is online, I don't know if it is. I'll include it in the show notes. It's really worth making. And I also like to make a vegan sour cream if I have vegan guests or whatever. Yeah. That's surprisingly convincing.
I remember once going to Charlie Was a Sinner.
That's a good spot.
It is. We've and talked it's a vegan restaurant. And they have they serve a ricotta cheese appetizer, but it's a vegan restaurant. So obviously mm-hmm. it's not ricotta cheese. It's a crumbled silken tofu
mm-hmm.
That's then dressed with olive oil and a few, like a sprinkle of Italian seasonings. And it's shockingly delicious.
Like, I haven't had that.
It's really convincingly milky. It's really good. I liked it a lot.
Interesting. I'll have to try that next time I go. Well, speaking of ricotta,
it's like we planned that or something.
I want to tell you something that I did with my leftover ricotta that I had for my recent visit to Mancuso's cheese shop, which is I just put it in a bowl and ate it. And it got me to thinking, like, why is ricotta not an equally good snack as, say, a Greek yogurt or yogurt or something?
I don't know.
It's very similar.
It is. And it's so delicious and savory. I mean, I wonder if it's in part because people think of a yogurt snack as being sweet. Although with this trend towards savory yogurt applications, I feel like ricotta is a very able substitute.
Well, that's one thing about the ricotta snack that I really appreciate is that when I have yogurt as a snack, I always buy plain yogurt.
Yeah.
And I will put some kind of sweetener on it, like a little honey, a little maple syrup. It's very rare that I eat it just some jam. That's another great way
always
to
good.
Have plain yogurt. But with ricotta, I have found that you can just drizzle on olive oil and salt and pepper, mm-hmm. and then no sugar is added. Or at one time, I chopped up olives to put in it.
Ooh, that sounds really good.
Or other, like a little topping of pickled vegetables would be terrific. And I did look up the nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
So a half cup of ricotta has 200 calories and 14 grams of protein.
Wow.
That's a high protein snack.
It is.
Yogurt, on the other hand, has, and then this is full fat plain we're talking about,
yeah.
has 150 calories, so 50 fewer calories, but 4.5 grams of protein. So it's three times the protein and only 50 more calories. So,
that's
great. Maybe it's a superior snack even to yogurt.
Well, one of the things that my maternal grandmother, not much of a cook, but innovated a few things that my mom and I still really enjoy. And one was that one of her favorite breakfasts was a piece of whole wheat toast with ricotta cheese on it and then sprinkled with a little pinch of salt and some onion powder, which sounds crazy. It is so good. So now I'm thinking maybe I'll just, next time I have some ricotta around, I'll skip the toast and just go for a little onion powder and salt.
Which, I mean, it's not just, ricotta also really lends itself to sweet stuff.
That's true.
It's very good with the drizzle of honey and fruit. I mean, you can definitely enjoy it that way, and I have. Sometimes if I have ricotta laying around and I just want like a dessert, I will do something like that and sort of think of it as like a little take on ricotta cheesecake almost.
Yeah, deconstructed.
Yeah. Totally cheater's version, but and this actually brings up another question I had for you in this whole ricotta field of inquiry. Yeah. Did you ever make your own ricotta from scratch?
I have once or twice years and years ago because I remember going to a press trip in California where it was all about lemons. It was the Sunkissed Lemon Grove, and they did all these demos. And one of the things they demonstrated was homemade or, you know, freshly made ricotta cheese with lemon juice and milk. And that was really it.
That's one of the appealing things. Yeah. That's all you need. You don't need rennet or anything else.
And it's really good. I mean, if you have really good high quality milk that's really fresh and you just squeeze that lemon juice in and a little salt, it is so delicious.
I think there's kind of no comparison.
Yeah.
I did have freshly made ricotta recently at a restaurant, and it really inspired me to make my own.
Yeah.
Not enough to have done it yet, mind you, but it's on my list of things that I want to do. Maybe I'll do it this week and report back.
You should. I'm excited. All right, Joy. So we're back to talking about something that was in Milk Street. Let's talk about carbon steel pans.
I'm not exaggerating when I tell you that since the last time we saw each other, this has been on my mind pretty much nonstop. Carbon steel pans are similar to cast iron and that you need to season them before you use them. They do require like a tiny bit of maintenance. And I know that some people use them as an alternative to nonstick, but I never quite, you know, clicked with this whole thing until I read an article in Milk Street all about the nonstick skillets. I mean, the carbon steel skillets. And I read through their approach to seasoning and their maintenance instructions. Hmm. And I had an old carbon steel pan that I had laying around and just gave up on at some point. And I tried to like bring it back to life. Uh-huh. I used their seasoning method, which was to bring like a tablespoon of oil to the smoking point and let it hold it there on your stovetop for a minute. And then, you know, basically remove the oil, wipe and repeat a number of times until you get a seasoning going. And then I think the tip that really changed my perspective on this is they, I guess when they were researching in Asia, they noticed that when it comes to woks and the carbon steel cookware they use there, often cooks will do like a mini pre-seasoning before they start to cook. So,
oh, interesting.
Yeah. They use a bit of old cooking oil and they put maybe a little teaspoon or a film of it in the pan before, you know, your cooking project starts. Bring it to the smoke point, hold it there for a minute, wipe it out, and then put your new fresh oil in. And this is what makes it perfectly nonstick.
Huh.
It has like, it was a huge scrambled eggs.
Really?
Yes. I really wait. I should have brought photos to show you. Maybe. yeah. So I've been making my scrambled eggs in this little now nonstick carbon steel.
Wow.
Cookware. But as usual for me, like I couldn't stop there. I kept like diving into everything I could read on the internet about it. And I discovered numerous other seasoning techniques. And I had to go over to Fonte's to buy a bigger nonstick skillet because I want to be able to make like 3 or 4 fried eggs, basically. Uh-huh. And then also stir fries, all the stuff that I've been using my nonstick for up until now.
Well, and I know that this nonstick has been an issue for you because you have an induction cooktop and not all nonstick works on it.
That's true. But that's not the only thing I hate about nonstick. Let me go over the reasons.
Okay.
It's lack of durability, does not last. How often do you feel like you have to replace your nonstick?
Probably every 2 or 3 years.
I think I go through them like once a year.
Really?
If I, that's about it. Although I've had some really crappy ones, I must say.
See, I buy some higher grade nonstick and then it does last longer, but it's more expensive. And then you feel really kind of unhappy about getting rid of a high quality nonstick pan because eventually it will break down.
So the case against nonstick pans are they're not durable. You have to replace them. That nonstick coating is made of toxic chemicals that are not just a problem when they're made, also in your home.
Yeah.
If you even just chip it on a microscopic level, you bring it just a shade hotter than it's supposed to be. Now you have toxic fumes in your house. They don't sear your food well and they do not create a fond. You cannot use them at high temperatures in the oven, especially. And, this is maybe just me or other people like me that have induction. There's poor compatibility with induction cooktops. Yeah. So for all of these reasons, I'm highly motivated to get rid of these pans. Like, and I think that I have found the way.
Well, I am really interested in this. So I had a carbon steel pan at one point that I had picked up at a thrift store. And I could never get it to the point where it was really usable. So now, and I got rid of it because I was like, well, if I can't make this useful for me, I'm not going to keep it around. But now because I have been fascinated by them. They've been gaining in popularity lately. You see more and more of them out there.
Well, first of all, like at a restaurant, there's no nonstick cookware in restaurants. They use only carbon steel.
Yeah.
And all over Europe, that's what home cooks use, you know.
Really?
As usual, we are very slow to catch on to things in America, especially if they're environmentally friendly and better for our health.
Yeah. Well, because I think as a culture, we don't like things that require a lot of maintenance.
Oh, yeah. And it's not a lot of maintenance.
But that's the perception.
Yeah. To me, like, it's so much – I feel like I'm making something that's going to last forever now, you know? Yeah. And I will say, you do need to add some fat to the pan. You're not going to get, like, a nonstick – surface that's like Teflon that you can fry an egg on with no fat, like, but I was not doing that anyway, you know. And it's just like, I don't know, I'm really excited. So, I've been like getting out of bed early in the morning, excited to make my eggs. Like, I just want to go see my pans.
So how is the new one, the larger one you bought? Is it, I guess because it was brand new, how long did it take you to get it from sort of the new state to usable?
I'm still applying what I'm going to call the initial seasoning.
Okay.
Because I decided, okay, so the seasoning in Milk Street with the, that I mentioned earlier about like bringing the oil to the smoke point on the stovetop, blah, blah, blah. I decided I was going to try something else that I found on the internet, which is coating it with a very thin coating of flax oil. Mm-hmm. I mean, to the point where you've like buffed it off and it seems like there's no oil on it. And then baking it at 500 degrees for an hour, letting it cool all the way down, and then repeating this like 5 or 6 times. So I'm trying this method on this pan. Seems to be working pretty well so far. But I haven't tried to use it yet.
And are you doing both the inside and the outside?
Yes. Okay. I don't know why. I just am.
Well, it's nice to get a patina over the whole thing.
And it prevents rust, I think. Yeah. So this to me has been like the absolute highlight of my week. A complete obsession. I'm thinking about it day and night. I'm thinking about it right now. This morning I put it in for another, you know, seasoning round, and I didn't open the oven because apparently there's something about it cooling on its own that helps the, I don't know, something
the polymers.
Chemical. Yeah.
So are you finding that you're using it above like cast iron? Are you still going to your cast iron pans? Do you think that they will replace them?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I'm definitely not getting rid of my cast iron pans. I want to get rid of my nonstick pans.
Yeah.
People say that they are equal to or superior to cast iron. I haven't been cooking with them long enough to weigh in on that.
Mm-hmm.
I am going to do something with the big one, the new one tonight, that I usually would do in my cast iron pan, which is, I mean, if you've listened to many episodes of this podcast, you've probably heard me talk about one of my favorite recipes, cracklin' chicken from Nom Nom Paleo, which involves putting your chicken skins or your chicken thighs skin side down in a pan and cooking them until they are very crisp.
Yeah.
This renders tons of fat. It holds the pan at a high temperature for a long time. So I think it's a good way. I think it'll be a good first thing to cook in the new pan that's, you know, after the initial seasoning is done. Because it will, you know, it'll accelerate the seasoning.
And are you finding that they're lighter? Like, are they easier to maneuver
and handle?
They're
definitely lighter and easier to handle than cast iron.
What's the price point of a carbon steel pan?
I have to say, I bought my new one yesterday in like a frenzy of, you know, I don't chop a lot.
Yeah.
But I like took myself to Fonte's because I had to have it like immediately.
Well, and good cookware is an investment.
I think it was around $50.
Oh my gosh, that's not bad at all for a piece of high quality cookware.
Oh, I wanted to mention the brand as well.
Okay.
I'm going to mispronounce it because it's French, I think. It's a Matfer Bourget or Bourget. I'll put a link to this on the show notes.
Okay.
If you didn't do your research like I did, you might be tempted. Lodge, you know, the famous cast iron company, makes a pre-seasoned carbon steel skillet that did not get good reviews.
Really?
In America's Test Kitchen carbon steel skillet write up and at other places. Apparently you're better off with a naked surface that you can season on your own. It was $54.
See, I think if it's going to replace your nonstick and last forever, that's an incredible, you know, price point for something where you're not going to have to, because I have paid that much for a single, like, higher quality nonstick that only lasts maybe 3 years. So I feel like that's a really good investment.
They also tested America's Test Kitchen when they did these pans, a hand forged version that's made in the Seattle area.
I think I've seen those. They have like cross hatching on the surface. Is that?
I don't know.
Okay.
They look a little blue because they used extra virgin olive oil, I guess, to do this initial seasoning. And they cost over $200.
Oh my gosh.
They're only available in the fall and spring. They're all sold out. Not that I was going to spend $200 on one of these.
Yeah.
But I was very curious. I signed up for their mailing list. But apparently they have a lot of them in the fall and spring, and then they sell out.
Well, I love this because I am a cookware nerd, and we're going to check back in about you and your carbon steel pans later on, Joy.
Yeah, I will update you guys next week. I plan to fry the tofu in it tomorrow. I'm doing the crispy chicken skins tonight, and I hope by the time I see you next week, I have cooked some fried eggs in them. And if you look online, you can see videos of fried eggs, like you know, sliding around the pan like a hockey puck.
Wow.
It's so cool. I've not been this excited about something in my kitchen in a while.
I love it. Well, we'll post lots of links to reviews and sources and some of these fried egg videos in the show notes. Now, Joy, what are you picking up at the market right now?
Last Wednesday, I got myself a big old haul of string beans.
I love string beans.
Well, I know you like to pickle them.
I love string beans any which way. They are one of my favorite vegetables. I like to pickle them. I like to roast them.
Me too.
I like to blister them in a pan and then use, you know, make them sort of spicy and salty. I like a string bean.
Well, I'll tell you the things that I did with my haul. The first thing I did was I put a bunch of them into ferment with garlic, dried chilies, fennel, and mustard seeds.
They're going to be delicious.
It's very good. I think I'm going to bring some to your house on election night.
Excellent.
And then the rest of them, I just steamed very simply.
Mm-hmm.
I have this thing that I like to do with vegetables where I put a tiny bit of water on the pan, then the vegetables, I steam them till they're crisp tender. And then before all the water is gone, I add like butter. So I have like a butter vegetable broth type sauce.
Yeah.
And like a little clove of garlic. That's the other thing really I did. So you like to roast them?
I do like to roast them. I like to steam them and eat them, you know, with butter. Scott doesn't like string beans, which is very sad. But one of my favorite things that I used to eat a lot when I was single was if I didn't know what to cook for dinner, I'd make myself scrambled eggs and steamed green beans with butter and a sliced tomato. Like, it was like my favorite summer solo dinner. But I like to put them in soups. My mom, when I was growing up, often made chicken soup and then would, you know, cut green beans into like 1-inch lengths and put them in the soup. I really loved even just kind of blanch them and eat them cold, you know.
They're really good for dipping.
They are really good for dipping.
Not raw, obviously, but blanched.
Yeah. I mean, I'll confess, I've eaten more than a handful of.
I guess if you get them super fresh.
Yeah. When I was in Portland last, I was with my mom at a friend's house and they had a garden with green beans that were at the end of their season. And I picked a generous handful and took them on the plane with me and just ate them raw, and they were so good.
You're lucky they didn't take them from you.
I am. You never know what they're going to take from you at the airport.
I think green beans are overlooked, string beans. They're not very glamorous. I don't see them at restaurants very much, but I do just love them.
Well, you see a haricot vert, I think. But yeah, no, I love them. And I love a wax bean. I love a Romano bean. I like a purple, you know, bean. I'll take beans any way they come.
Yeah, they're pretty good.
Yeah.
I should make them more.
I think so.
Well, are we at the end of our line here?
We are, and it's your turn.
All right. That's it for our show today. Our thanks go out to Dan Call for editing and to Saul Rosenbaum for designing our logo. Thank you, Raina Rose, for providing our music, and thank you for listening. If you like what you hear, please subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at Local Mouthful. Sign up for our newsletter, listen to our old episodes, and check out our show notes at localmouthful.com. Until next time, happy eating.